Britain says it will drop clauses in draft domestic legislation that breach the Brexit withdrawal agreement, just after clinching a deal with the EU. The UK becomes the first Western country to start vaccinating its general population in the midst of a global attempt to contain the coronavirus pandemic. China summons the acting top U.S. diplomat in Beijing to protest at U.S. sanctions on 14 Chinese officials over Hong Kong. Welcome to World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Britain saying it has reached a deal with the EU to manage post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland. Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove says that London will drop clauses in draft domestic legislation that breached the withdrawal agreement. He says the agreement is in principle on all issues, in particular with regard to the protocol on the Ireland-Northern Ireland border. The deal is, however, separate from the ongoing future trade talks between London and Brussels. EU chief negotiators said earlier the bloc is fully united over its approach and will refuse any undue sacrifices to secure a trade deal with Britain. Michel Barnier added that if Britain wanted access to the EU market, then it would have to accept conditions. The two sides remained at loggerheads over a number of issues. Britain has started mass vaccination against coronavirus, becoming the first Western country to do that. A 90-year-old grandmother has become the first person to receive the Pfizer vaccine a week after Britain approved its use. The country is planning to vaccinate 2 million people by the end of the year, and more next year. First in line for vaccination are the most vulnerable people, as well as frontline health and social care workers. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the vaccination campaign is a huge step forward in the UK's fight against COVID-19. The country is one of the worst hit nations by the virus in the world. It has 61,000 deaths out of more than 1.6 million infections. Said Kuruza says a safety concern prevails among Britons as the government has started mass vaccination against COVID-19.
They have rolled out this vaccine. They're calling it V-Day, Vaccination Day, a term coined by the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. They have already procured 800,000 doses of it, although they have ordered another 40 million, which will be enough to vaccinate a lot of people, like 20 million people. Most of that 40 million doses will be available until next year, although the government here is saying that 4 million doses should arrive in the country by the end of next month. There are concerns about its safety among members of the public. One prime reason is that the vaccine was developed in 10 months, a process from concept to reality that usually takes years. Some even are saying 10 years. But whether or not it'll have the impact, or are we going to see after effects or symptoms, is just something we're going to have to wait and see.
China has summoned the acting top U.S. diplomat in Beijing to lodge its protest at new American sanctions on China's officials over Hong Kong. The foreign ministry said it had summoned the diplomat to express, quote, solemn protest and a strong condemnation. The ministry also warned of taking reciprocal measures. On Monday, Washington imposed financial sanctions and a travel ban on all 14 vice chairpersons of China's National People's Congress. Well, that's over their role in adopting a national security law for Hong Kong and disqualification of elected opposition legislators in the city last month. Beijing regards Hong Kong as part of China and has time and again accused the U.S. of interfering in its internal affairs. Syria's newly appointed foreign minister has visited Iran. Faisal al-Maqdad met with Iran officials and discussed the regional issues. Youssef Jalali reports.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Maqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani. Or the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is too low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting any help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering.
Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, based on a report, the number of Afghan civilians killed in air raids by the U.S. and its allies soared more than threefold in 2019 compared to 2 years ago. According to the Cost of War Project at American Brown University, the number of civilians killed in U.S.-led raids surged 330% to some 700 last year. That's reportedly the highest figure since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism in 2001. The study attributed the rising figures to the U.S. relaxing of its rules of engagement in 2017 and escalating attacks on Taliban militants. The U.S. military in Afghanistan has rejected the report as one-sided. It says it relies on disputed data that ignores civilian casualties caused by the Taliban and Daesh groups. Turkey has urged the European Union to play a role of an honest mediator in its deadlock with Greece over Ankara's oil and gas exploration in the East Mediterranean.
We expect the EU to always act strategically and rationally. We expect it to contribute to the solution of existing problems. For this, the EU should play a role of an honest mediator.
In a joint presser with his Hungarian counterpart, Çavuşoğlu said that Turkey is trying to improve relations with the bloc. He added that issues between the two sides can be resolved if the EU acts with common sense. Now, those comments came a day after EU foreign ministers said that they were considering sanctions against Turkey. The EU leaders are expected to discuss the issue in their Thursday meeting. Tensions escalated between Ankara and Athens in August after Turkey sent an exploration ship to the waters also claimed by Greece. Athens slammed the move as illegal and requested the EU impose sanctions on Ankara. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says that he believes a win-win formula can be found in the row with Greece over the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, those remarks came as the EU is mulling sanctions on his country ahead of an upcoming key summit, Rajan Saklan reports.
The EU is set to decide on sanctions against Turkey over Eastern Mediterranean tensions this week. European Union final decision will take place on Thursday on the grounds of recommendations from the EU foreign ministers meeting. The EU has been involved in Ankara-Athens tensions for a while now, since Turkey sent a search vessel to a disputed area. This comes as Turkish president is seeking to push for dialogue between conflicting parties and countries of the Mediterranean, including North and South Cyprus, assuring that Turkey is only after what belongs to it.
Biz kimsenin hakkını...
We are not after exploiting anyone's rights, but are only taking a firmer stance against pirates that try to take our rights away. All actors will be able to find a win-win solution when everyone acts consciously with common sense and sincerity.
Turkey and Greece have been at loggerheads over the Eastern Mediterranean underwater energy resources dispute. Ankara enraged Athens by sending a research vessel to a disputed area in August, and since then, Greece has been calling EU to take actions against Turkey. However, many say it is not easy for the EU to take actions against Turkey for several reasons, including refugee deal and economic relations between Ankara and the bloc. Turkey says it had already shown goodwill when retrieving Eritrea's vessel and agreeing on dialogue without preconditions. Many here believe the EU will not take serious actions against Turkey and is only after pushing Turkey to stop its activities in the region until a solution is found. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Thank you for staying tuned. Time now for the news review. Welcome to the news review. The UN has raised the alarm about the worsening humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia's Flashpoint Tigray region. It says access to deliver aid there is desperately needed. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says that the situation in Tigray is increasingly critical, and it's vital that humanitarian aid, humanitarian workers are able to urgently assist the people there. Ethiopia's prime minister ordered its troops into Tigray last month after alleged attacks by the region's People's Liberation Front on federal military camps. Abiy Ahmed declared victory in late November and said that efforts were being made to restore order. However, continued fighting and lawlessness have been hampering relief efforts to thousands of people displaced recently. Nearly 100,000 Eritrean refugees who had fled their country years ago are also living in multiple camps in Tigray. Time now to discuss the issues. So joining me will be Abiyomi Ezekiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit, and Bekele Teklu, African Affairs expert from London. Good to have you on the show, gentlemen. Over to Detroit first. Abiyomi, what can be done about this plight that the Eritrean refugees are suffering in Tigray?
I think that the regional leadership in the Tigray region is responsible for this crisis. The federal government under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed had just requested the postponement of elections due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and they went ahead in September with elections. And then in November, they attacked the representatives of the federal government in the Tigray region. So the government really had no alternative except to move into the region to restore the authority of Addis Ababa. The government has committed itself to opening up a humanitarian corridor in the area, and also to cooperate with the Sudanese government in providing assistance to people who have fled to Eastern Sudan as well. But we have to look at the political dimensions of this conflict, and in assessing that, then we can make some judgments about the humanitarian crisis and how to resolve it as well.
Mm-hmm. Now over to London. Mr. Teklu, who's responsible for this, and what can be done to tackle the suffering of the people?
To be honest, with the Ethiopian people were suffering a lot for some time. This is not their first time. As we speak, if we go in Benishangul, a lot of people are displaced. If we go into Wollongong province and the southern region, a border to Kenya and South Sudan, a lot of people are displaced, and a lot of people are killed and starving. There is all over an instability. So the only solution we might have is a general consensus among the people and have the right, you know, transitional system where all people are included, in the dialogue.
Okay, and Abiyomi, are you optimistic that people could be reached out to?
The government has set up a new political party, the Prosperity Party, which the TPLF refused to participate in. There needs to be some amendments to the federal constitution. The system of federalism, as it has been enacted, particularly under the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, which took power in 1991, actually at the aegis of the United States, under the Bush senior administration. Herman Cohen, who was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during that period, is still intervening and interfering in the internal affairs of Ethiopia. I think the federal system, as it is set up now, had favored the TPLF and the EPRDF, and they are quite disturbed that a new political dispensation is being ushered in right now, which is also connected with relations with neighboring Eritrea as well.
Okay, Bekele, you have 30 seconds for your final comments.
In the first place, since the TPLF came into power in 1991 with the support and common action of the EPLF, and their base is ethnic base, and due to that, the last 20, 30 years, this ethnic division was heightened, a lot of problems created, or the youngsters are, you know, raised with this situation. So unless that root problem is dismantled, I mean, there is not going to be a solution. In the first place, the people of Ethiopia rejected the EPRDF. That means that all is ideas, logic, and so on. If they are coming in a different form, it's not going to work.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. We had Abiyomi as a Kiwa editor with Pan-African Newswire from Detroit, and Bekele Teklu, African Affairs expert, who joined us from London. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing 69 Minutes of 86 Days, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Egil Hoshel Larsen. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morningstar newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist in both television and radio for many years. And beside her is Zita Holborn, who is the co-founder and national chair of Barack UK and has been coordinating solidarity, aid and fact-finding missions in support of refugees in France for over 2 years. Now, 69 Minutes of 86 Days is a documentary about the hardships of being a refugee as seen through a child's eyes. With minimal dialogue, the director takes us into the journey of three-year-old Syrian child Leanne and shows her family trekking through Europe with the goal of reuniting with her grandfather to settle in Sweden. First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a magnificent documentary, extremely moving, and it's the kind of documentary that stays with you for days, especially because it was told from a child's perspective. Now, Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your impression of this documentary?
Well, it does stay with you, and I found that it was one of the most unique documentaries on the refugee crisis that I've seen, and actually quite an impressive directorial debut by Larson himself. He was a cameraman, he was a cinematographer, and you can tell that in the way that it's shot. And what's interesting is that he shot it from her perspective and her height. So the camera moves with her. And it's very intriguing and inspiring use of putting this story across. And it's quite a humanizing way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the little girl is well, adorable. And the fact is that there are no voiceovers, there's no narration, you have no idea what's going on, very much like the little girl herself, Leanne. She has no idea. You know, at three, you go where you're taken. And for her, in many ways, it was kind of like a game, although at times the camera kind of stays on her and she looks really, really serious.
I wanted to ask you actually a bit more about that point, about the style of the filmmaking, because the Larson does use low-angle steadicam shots mixed with long takes, as you were saying. And do you think that the director, Larson, was successful in trying to transfer the child's experience to the viewer in this way?
Well, I think so, because you can see her energy and her hope and her childlike wonderment. When the film opens, it's a tracking shot of the beach, and you see all these things strewn on it. You have no idea what's coming or where it's going, and then it kind of tracks up. You see all these refugees queuing up. They're being given flip-flops. Been given food, and then it hones in on her and her look and what's going through her little mind. We have no idea. You know, it's a child's world. But to her, you know, it's all games as well. But she knows that she's being taken from her home to Sweden, and that's how we learn about it, because at no point are you told where they are, where they're going, really, apart from a song that she sings where she says, "Oh, we're going to Sweden in Germany to live with Grandpa," you know.
That was a really endearing moment.
Yeah,
I think it was there to help keep her going through that journey. And Zita, I want to bring you in here. What was your impression of the film? Do you agree with Maria's take?
I agree with quite a bit of what Maria has said. I think it was quite endearing to show it through the eyes of a child in the way it was shot. It was a unique perspective that we don't normally see or hear. Usually the times we hear about children are in a very technical way, as you know, unaccompanied minors or when they've tragically died. So it was positive to see it from the perspective of a child, but I also think that in some places, you know, the narrative was missing. But you have to look at what the purpose of the film was, and was it to do what lots of other people have done before, or was it to do something different and to show this perspective on it?
No, I agree with you, actually, and I want to explore those details a bit later on in terms of how powerful that impact had by having minimal dialogue. She's such a cute, gorgeous little girl, Leanne, and as a viewer, I feel like you feel the need to protect her in that hostile world that she's in. And Maria, you were touching upon this a bit earlier on. What are some of the hardships that we witness Leanne and her family encounter on their journey?
Well, there's an interesting shot of them all being sort of held against a barrier, and the police kind of treating these refugees as cattle, really. And you kind of think, that this isn't on, you know, this isn't right. But I don't think that's what the film wants to show you. I think it wants to show you the fact that they don't know what's happening. She doesn't know what's happening. It's crazy. It's frightening in many ways. And it's disorientating. So hence why there's no narration. You have no idea where they are at any given time, what country they're in.
Do you think this is a metaphor in general, sorry, as the viewers, that we sympathise with Leanne because it's a metaphor for the Western audience's general ignorance of the issue, perhaps? That we don't know where they are, what's happening.
Well, exactly, yes, in some ways. And also that she's an ordinary little girl. She's got a backpack from the film Frozen. You know, this could be any of us at any given time. And basically to, you know, come to terms, sort of empathise with her situation. The thing is, we've seen films where you see children being, you know, treated horrifically. And so this is a different way of getting the message across. and poignantly, and with this three-year-old girl, and she is very similar. I mean, she's gorgeous to look at, and very sweet and very cute and very funny. There's a scene where she's playing with her sister, and she's, you know, giving her a lollipop, and the whole thing is that the family are trying to keep it as normal as possible, but it isn't a normal situation.
Mm. And Zita, from your experience working with refugees and refugee children, what kind of conditions are they enduring and kind of problems that they have on journey?
Well, they're going through horrific conditions and experiences. What we didn't see in the film for Leanne is some of the experiences that refugee children that I've met and worked with, where you know, they're having to cross deserts, where they're having to go on very small boats in perilous conditions across the Mediterranean Sea. And effectively, you know, the families are risking their lives to get them to a safe place. They're staying in very harsh conditions, where at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Calais, with both of the camps destroyed, people don't have tents. They're staying outside. The police have been stealing their blankets and their sleeping bags, if they get them, and stripping those away from them. They were over the last few months, they've had a one-hour slot in which they can access a tank of water to have a wash in front of hundreds of people. So actually, the conditions are stark. When there wasn't an infrastructure in Dunkirk, and particularly in Calais, there was a school and an art school, and so there was some system in place for children to have, you know, snippets of normality.
So would you say that Leanne is one of the lucky ones that got away?
If you look at her journey in the film, the bits that we see of it, seems to be quite a positive journey compared to some of the refugee children I've met. I'm not saying it's completely positive, because obviously a long journey like that, there are risks all the way. It's tiring. You're staying in tents and camps and so on, so it's not easy. But I also think I don't quite agree with you in terms of Leanne's naivety. I think actually she's very intelligent and very articulate. And if you listen to the little things she says and the little songs she sings, you can see actually she is reflecting on her conditions, particularly on the coach when she talks about what happened to the cat.
Mm. Yeah? Yes, I thought that was more really engaging. I wish I saw more of those scenes. So as we were saying, we do enjoy watching these tender, sweet moments with Leanne and these precious moments. I think they give us a sense of relief from the harsh reality of a refugee's life. Maria, the director, Larsen, said at the Copenhagen Film Festival earlier this year that in this film he didn't want to focus so much on the political aspect of the refugee crisis. He wanted to focus more on a child's perspective and sort of it gives some hope, I suppose, to their situation. Do you think that the film should have been more political, though?
It's an interesting question. The thing is, if it had been more political, then it would have been like every other documentary that we've seen on the refugee crisis. He was trying to get his point of view across by Leanne, and he succeeded that to certain extent. The thing is that it is a snapshot of what they went through. We don't know what the rest of it was like. You know, anyone who has a three-year-old, to keep them entertained for 86 days, I'm sorry, but it would be a nightmare, you know. The thing is, we need to be hopeful, but we need to change people's attitudes, and people are now kind of entrenched about the Syrian refugee crisis, sadly, and this is a different way of putting it across, to engage people in that discussion and to look at it. It is, you know, we're like voyeurs in this film, and what we see is what he's allowing us to see. So the rest may have not been as touching or, you know, as moving or as sweet as the scenes that we saw. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, you know, as I said, keeping a three-year-old entertained or protected from what's going on is really difficult. Their attention span is very short.
Mm-hmm. And I think Larsen used the child, though, on purpose in the sense that she's untainted by the world, and she's an innocent, pure soul. So she doesn't know the differences with the cultural and political conflicts.
No.
So in a sense, it gives you a sort of humanistic approach, I think, to the refugee crisis.
And you need to put a face on it. That's the thing. You've got to humanize people. You know, you can't just say, you know, bunch of Syrian refugees as a whole. These are people. These are people just like you and like us, going through terrible ordeal. You know, to have to move from, you know, your country to somewhere completely foreign. My parents did it, you know, in the 60s.
And my mother kind of never got over it, really, because it was a completely different cultural culture coming to Britain. Circumstances, you can't, they're not comparable. But what I'm saying is, if you have to leave your home, and in their case, they're forced to leave their home to go somewhere else, and people are not giving them the respect that they kind of deserve, or the kindness. Do you see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean. It's a really good point.
It's, you know, we're supposed to, you know, care for everyone. We're supposed to care for each other. And we've become, you know, in the world now where it's every man and woman for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Zita, I just wanted to read a statistic here about refugees. So according to the UN Refugee Agency, 86% of the world's refugees are hosted by developing countries. So the countries hosting the most refugees are Turkey, home to some 2.5 million. Pakistan, 1.6 million, Lebanon, 1.1 million, and Iran, around 1 million. Now, what do you think of the Western world's efforts in sheltering and accommodating the refugees? Do you think they could be doing a better job?
They could definitely be doing far more than they're doing. Actually, the UK record is woeful. You know, for 2 years I've been working with people who are refugees in France who are stuck in limbo, effectively, trying to get to the UK. Many of them are children. The average age currently of the people that are there, if you want to call them adults, is around age 17 or 18. So this is very young people that have left home when they were children, have struggled and travelled alone, may have lost all their family members, have had to form bonds and family, to travel across Europe to try and get to a safe place, and are being separated from their families and connections here in the UK. And then all the scapegoating and demonising of migrants, and trying to blame the cuts and austerity impact that we're experiencing here on migrants is an absolute disgrace. We've had the Immigration Act introduced in the UK, which is like seeks to create an apartheid-like state. And then even when people are here, we're seeing mass deportations to countries like Jamaica, Nigeria, and Pakistan. So yes, the UK and other European Western countries could do far more. They're not demonstrating humanity. And actually, I think that's what we saw in the film. We saw the human story. We saw humanity. We saw the reality of a family trying to shield and protect their children. And you could see the sadness and pain and fear in the eyes of the adults. But they tried to protect the children from that and, you know, keep things positive so that the children, and particularly Leanne, could have hope for a better future.
Thank you for that point. It was a really good point. I want to touch more on what you were saying about the anti-refugee sentiment across Europe. Now, we're in the final part of the discussion of this programme now, and I just want to talk a little bit about how, in the documentary, there isn't no specific reference to the country of origin of the refugees. Do you think Larson did this in an attempt to perhaps internationalise the refugee issue?
Maybe, but also to keep you disorientated in a way, like they were. We assume that they started off from a Greek port and then... they go through, I think they went through Hungary and Austria and then Germany and then on to Sweden. But you have no idea where they're going or what's the passage of time, actually. You know, and only by the signposts and people speaking in German do you realise they're in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's basically to keep it, you know, to keep you on your toes and to give you the experience or part of the experience that they went through, because Leanne had no idea where she was going.
And Zita, would you agree with Marie's take?
Not necessarily. I can't speculate on why it was done like that and why it wasn't mentioned. You know, within a few minutes, I'd figured out that's where they were from anyway, because I can hear them speaking and, you know, I can look at them and guess where they're from. But actually, I think the important part of the film wasn't about, he wasn't trying to tell their backstory and what they were fleeing from. There was no focus on that. It was about the journey you go on as a refugee. So all people who are refugees are going through those same trials and tribulations and challenges, and, you know, it's tiring, it's long, it's challenging. So I think that the focus was on this is what you're going through. Here is a family who are a tight family, who are supporting each other, looking after each other. They're a loving family. You know, they're embracing their children. They're sticking together. And this is what you have to do to get through a perilous and long and difficult journey, which is not just physically difficult, but actually mentally and spiritually.
And psychologically, yeah. Definitely. But I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people would argue that, in fact, refugees getting to their destination in Europe is actually not the hardest part, given the rise of the increase in anti-refugee, anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe, with far-right groups, for example. Do you think it's likely that children such as Leanne will face a lot of racism and abuse once they settle in the countries?
Absolutely. Actually, I sat, you know, as the credits came up at the end of the film, thinking, okay, this is all very fairy tale, happily ever after. This is not the reality of what people go through as refugees, or even migrating, you know, where my family came and migrated to the UK. She will face discrimination. And often young people that I meet who are refugees in France, they ask, what's it like in the UK? It's better there, and it's going to be better for us, and it's going to be better equality. And I'm truthful to them. I tell them what I do as an activist, that actually my entire life has been dedicated to campaigning against racism and prejudice and xenophobia, because we're still facing those challenges. So it won't be easy for her. It's going to be challenging.
So Marie, would you like to see a follow-up documentary to see how Leanne's life would play out?
It would be interesting, but again, if he's going to go for this style of documentary, then, you know, it's cinematic, basically. But I suspect as a three-year-old, I mean, I was 10 months old when I came to Britain, you get used to your surroundings and, you know, you become part of society and you forget what...
You integrate
there. And she's three, and she will presumably integrate. But yeah, it's...
Perhaps many challenges lay ahead. And
indeed. And it's scary times at the moment, and also post-Brexit, I have to say. So
it's scary times indeed. And I'm afraid we'll have to end it there, but thank you very much. I enjoyed this discussion of the documentary. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks to my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, regarding a question of miscellaneous nature related to Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Khomeini, let me ask you about a special style of having or keeping the beard known as goatee. You know, some people, in fact, some men tend to have or keep their hair around their chin and, you know, and shave the rest of their beard except that part which is around the chin. Yeah. Well, so what is Ayatollah Khamenei's view on this? Is this practice, is this form or style of keeping the beard okay?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You may know very well that the Shiite scholars have different opinions regarding the goatee beard or the French cut beard.
Mm-hmm.
French cut beard.
Yes.
Some scholars consider the, for example, the French cut beard as sufficient. For example, Ayatollah Khui is one of those scholars. And there are many other scholars whom I know, and they have this, they are of the view that the French cut beard is sufficient. But Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, they are of the view that the goatee beard is not sufficient, and therefore it's not permissible for an individual to shave the beard on the two sides of your face and leave the hair on the chin, okay, as an obligatory precaution, because all the religious authorities have exercised precaution.
Mm-hmm.
They have said that shaving beard is not permissible as an obligatory precaution. There is no fatwa, a straight fatwa,
yes,
with regards to the beard. And therefore, the followers of Grand Ayatollah Khamenei should not shave the beard on the two sides of their on the sides of their faces, and they have to keep it, and also they keep it also the hair on the chin, and this is what he suffices as complete beard. Okay, the beard on the chin, which is called the French cut beard, is not sufficient according to him, and also according to Grand Ayatollah Sistani. Both of them, I think, see eye to eye with each other in this regard.
I see. What about the oldest style of keeping the beard in Britain, which is exactly the opposite of the French cut beard?
Yeah,
like they grow or they keep the sideburns.
Yes.
All right. But they shave only the hair which is around the chin on the chin.
Of course, that's not permissible, because what actually manifests is comes as a manifestation of beard is the hair on the chin.
Right.
And this is what is perceived to be the beard in general opinion. Okay. Now, if this is cut, then that person does not consider to be a bearded person.
Uh-huh.
That's a British style beard.
Yes.
Which is not acceptable according to Islamic Sharia.
I see. It's not Islamic beard then.
It's not Islamic. Yes.
I see.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Is it permissible to work in places or centers that Muslims consider as corrupt? For example, in nightclubs, or for example, in the food processing factories where you can see pork is usually processed or even sold, all right? Like special supermarkets where you sell stuff such as this, which are not only of the Islamically, sacrificed type of, for example, meat, but also it comes from the fact that, for example, it comes from the dog meat or the pork, like the pig's meat, you know, and stuff like that, which are considered in and of it themselves impure.
Impure, yes.
All right? What happens to the job and having a position or a post in such places? And what about the idea and the religious view of Ayatollah Khamenei on the money which is earned from such places?
Well, Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion is strict. It is more strict as compared to Ayatollah Sistani's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Ayatollah Sistani, for example, says that it's not permissible to sell, for example, pork or dog meat as an obligatory precaution. Ayatollah Sistani exercises precaution. But Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that it's absolutely not permissible to do anything associated with pork, with haram meat, even if that haram meat is not the meat of a dog or a pork, okay? If that meat is the meat of, let's say, a dead animal,
yes,
which has not been sold, slaughtered according to Islamic law,
yes,
it is not permissible to do anything associated with that meat, unless there is, for example, a logical or a justified reason, okay? For example, you are working in a factory processing meat which is going to be used for feeding dogs, for feeding animals, or for any other purposes other than eating and consumption, okay?
Yes.
It's permissible. But if this food is processed in order to be sold out on the market, or to be served to clients, to even non-Muslims who who have no objection to eating, for example, pork, to eating haram meat, even then it's not permissible to deal with such stuff, with such material, with such things. And therefore, it's not permissible to work in an alcohol factory or in a brewery or in a, let us say, in a slaughterhouse in which pork is, in which pigs are slaughtered, maybe dog meat is processed,
mm-hmm.
is not permissible.
Yes.
While Ayatollah Sistani says there's no problem in working in such places, it is permissible to work. But what is for...
Not immediately involved, as you said, in one of the earlier episodes, I believe.
He says that selling it, uh-huh. you know, that we might have talked about, we may have discussed this issue from
yes.
the viewpoint of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, okay?
Yes.
He says that selling it is not permissible as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, selling means that you are someone who carries the meat and give it and hand it over to the client or to the
yes.
customer.
Yes.
This is not permissible. But if you are actually indirectly involved, if you are just carrying something, pork.
Yes, as a chauffeur, as a driver.
As a driver.
Or as a bodyguard or security, for
yes,
example.
Yes, there's no problem. This is Ayatollah Sistani's opinion. But Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion is very strict. He says it's absolutely not permissible. He has actually a fatwa. He's not exercising precaution in this regard.
Uh-huh.
He says it's not permissible to do anything associated with pork, with haram things like haram meat, okay?
Yes.
Let alone alcohol. There is consensus about alcohol. Doing anything with alcohol is forbidden. No work can be done. According to Ayatollah Sistani and according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and all other religious authorities, carrying, for example, things which, for example, a package of, let's say, alcoholic bottles, or doing anything which promotes alcohol,
mm-hmm.
advertising, or working with a branch of the factory which
yes.
somehow deals with alcohol
yes.
is not permissible according to both the religious authorities.
Would you quickly answer the first part? I also asked you about the nightclubs.
Yeah, nightclub is also not permissible according
uh-huh.
to Ayatollah Khamenei, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He has clearly and expressly stated that it's not permissible to work
For nightclubs or casinos, for example.
Or casinos, of course.
I see.
The income which is generated from this is not permissible. It's haram.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh
Javid.
That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim Majid. La ilaha illa hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Samee Basir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.